words about that, and then I'll describe some of the physics of QCD at large n, and since we're interested in large n, it'll actually be pure gauge theories, although it'll be interesting to see how the fermionic corrections work as you go to large n. So this will be SUN gauge theories at large n. There was a very nice introduction in the previous talk to lattice calculations, so I don't have to say too much about that. Just to remind you that the degrees of freedom are elements of the gauge group on the links of the lattice. The lattice is on a 4-torus, so you've taken Euclidean R to the 4, put it on a 4-torus, discretized it to a hypercubic lattice. The natural variables which compare color at points which are a discrete distance apart are elements of the gauge group, and if that distance becomes infinitesimal, then of course you can expand the elements of the gauge group and get the usual gauge potentials. As we saw, you can use any closed loop as a gauge invariant action, and the simplest closed loop is that around the elementary plaquette, and that's a gauge invariant product of 4 link matrices, and it gives you, if you sum it over, you put on landscape. Landscape, ah. No, no, it's okay, there's a landscape mode somewhere here. Image rotation here, if you want. Yeah, I can do image rotation. Yeah, I think this is all you get. I mean, I can't see what you can see. Well, yes, you see something very dim. Do you? Let's see, white balance, contrast. Sorry? Well, I want the blackboard lights. I'd rather have the blackboard. I'll be using, is it really in the way, the blackboard? Okay. No, not okay now. No, no, no. Take off those lights, please. Ah. Well, anyway, that's so then you end up with a partition function like this, where you're integrating over the elements of the group on each of the links with an action up here in the exponential and a parameter in front of it. And it's going to be, it's ensured by the symmetries that you've maintained here that is going to give you the right continuum theory. And you can see from that that the beta will go to something times 1 over g squared, and indeed it happens to be 2n over g squared if you do this more carefully. And so the g squared is the bare coupling, which is, if you like, a definition of a running coupling on the scale of the lattice spacing, since everything here is defined on the lattice spacing scale. And so if you want to vary the lattice spacing, you vary beta. That's your way of tuning the lattice spacing. And then you do a Monte Carlo, where you generate a set of lattice fields which are generated with this measure. And so any expectation value can be calculated by just calculating that operator, that function over for the specific fields you've calculated and averaging over those values. There should be a normalization factor here, which I've forgotten. Now, okay, so that's the background lattice, and the sort of things you might want to do is to calculate masses from Euclidean correlators. And if you do that, you can see that you will get the usual decomposition in terms of eigenstates of Hamiltonian, and if you go to larger T, the lightest mass dominates, and what you know is the number of lattice spacings and the time-like direction, so your masses are all in lattice units. Then you can calculate several such masses, take ratios of pairs, the lattice scale cancels, and then you can take a continuum limit by repeating the calculation for different values of the lattice spacing and putting in what is the order a squared correction one believes is the leading correction on theoretical grounds. And then if you've done that and obtained the continuum limit, you can do the same thing for different values of n and see how that ratio varies when you vary n. So the important question here is whether SU3 is close to SU infinity for a number of simple quantities. and whether it's also confining in the large N limit, because in that case, large N is of phenomenological relevance, which is a sort of crucial issue before one even starts. So if you want to see the accuracy of a typical lattice mass calculation, this is a lightest gluonic state in SU3 at a fairly small lattice spacing. Here's a correlation function. You can see you have a very nice exponential here. The reason that this is such a nice exponential is because behind this calculation there lies a variational calculation amongst over a basis of lattice operators, which has been carefully chosen to have a good overlap onto physical states. I won't go into that. That's a technical detail. But the point is that you can do accurate calculations, giving you masses of the sort of plus or minus 2% level, which is the sort of level which enables you to do reasonably good continuum extrapolations. And let me just show you one continuum extrapolation here in SU3. So that's... that's a zoom. Okay.
Okay. So here is the global mass divided by the square root of the string tension, plotted against the simultaneously calculated values of the string tension in lattice units. So this measures the correction, leading correction. And here are the values from the coarsest lattice spacing to the finest lattice spacing for the lightest scalar global mass. And here's the lightest tensor global. And this mass ratio, where the ratio is the square root of the string tension, is, well, you can see that it's fairly well controlled. And you get some continuum extrapolated values like this. So you can get accurate continuum extrapolations of various quantities. And then you can compare them as a function of n, which is the crucial point I wanted to come to. So you repeat that for SU2, done it for SU3 here, SU4, SU6, and SU8. And this is what you find for the lightest globals in units of the square root of the string tension, this dimensionless ratio here. What you see is that you have, so this is SU2. I'm plotting it against 1 over n squared, which is expected to be the functional form of the leading correction to the large n limit. And this is SU3. And as you can see, while there may be the errors may be underestimated here, and I could go into that, the systematic errors in particular, nonetheless, it's very clear that there is a SU3 is close to large n, the value for these particular global states. So that's good news. That's good news. It tells us that physical quantities are already, in some sense, close to their large N limit, even by the time you get to SU3. Do you have so what about confinement? Let me just give you one plot of that from SU6. So this is a calculation that we did some time ago, about 2 years ago, with Harvey Mayer when he was in Oxford. So this is the way we were calculating the string tension. And most of the things you've seen so far have been the potential. You look at the potential, and then you look at the string tension by looking at large enough distances where the potential is rising linearly. But this is another way which many people use, which is to use the fact that our spatial volume is a torus. It's a three torus. So what you can do is you can wrap chromoelectric flux around this torus and see whether it organizes itself into a flux tube. That is to say, you vary the size, the spatial size, the size of this torus, and see whether the lightest energy of this chromoelectric flux actually grows linearly with the length. So that's, and there are expectations even about the correction, because if the thing is for large, when the length is large, so here you put these Podyakov loops, or some version of Podyakov loops, which has good overlaps on physical states, and look at the correlation function much the same way I did for the global and showed you an example a couple of minutes ago. Calculate the lightest mass of such a loop, and that should be string tension times L with corrections. The leading correction for large L is called the Lucia term, and that is, this is effectively the central charge up here of the effective string theory that describes the long-distance physics of confining flux tubes. And here it's assumed to be a bosonic string, and there's very good evidence from various sources that that is the case. But so let me show you, all I want to show you is some evidence for linear confinement beyond SU3. So here is SU6. And so as you can see, the mass, the lightest mass of such a flux loop wrapped around the torus does grow roughly linearly with the size of the torus. And the corrections, if we looked at it more carefully, are compatible initially with those Lucia corrections here. I don't show you that here, but that's the case. And in fact, something like a Nambu-Goto would do even better. So but the main point is this approximate linearity, and you would get very much the same kind of plot in SU3. So this is a demonstration, the kind of demonstration that you have in SU3 for linear confinement, and here it's for SU6. So so all this is telling us, and this is kind of preamble, this is telling us that we can do reasonably accurate calculations of these quantities. I try to demonstrate that to you in case some of you, of course, have seen these kind of things before and don't need to see it again, but some of you haven't, so that's why I showed it. And then I showed you that for some quantities, SU3 is indeed close to SU infinity for some basic quantities, the first ones you might calculate, and that indeed linear confinement persists at large n, appears to persist at large n. So we've got the basic ingredients there for thinking of large n as being phenomenologically relevant. And motivated by this, let's look at finite temperature, which is the topic of this talk. So what I decided to do is just kind of tell you a few of the things that have been calculated at larger n, because some of them are buried in papers and may not be very transparent to those of you who are doing calculations from the stringy side of various quantities. And I'd like you to know that they actually exist, so that's why I'm going to be telling you about them. And there's quite a, in a sense, it's going to be a bit of a list of things with examples. And I will try not to make too many interesting remarks so that I can get through this list as quickly as possible, otherwise I'll get bogged down in some discussion. So if I'm well-disciplined, I'll say very little. But let's see how it goes. So the first thing we can focus on is the deconfining temperature itself in SUN gauge theories. And this has been calculated some time ago by a group of us. And what you see here is the continuum limit of the deconfining temperature in an SUN gauge theory in units of a string tension from SU2 up to SU8. And once again, you can see that you have very little dependence and looks very nice. There's a rapid convergence to large n. In fact, it looks almost too nice because the SU2 point, which corresponds to a second order phase transition while the rest are first order, lies on that line as well. That's, of course, that's, there are other higher order 1 over n squared correction. 1 over n to the fourth corrections are undoubtedly there. It's just that with the kind of accuracy we've got here, you don't need them. Anyway, from SU3 onwards, you have a first order transition, and you can fit with this. So you get, roughly speaking, 0.6 at n equals infinity for Tc over root sigma. So that's one. And as was remarked by the previous speaker, the way you do finite temperature is to, of course, is to give yourself a fourth direction which is shorter than the other three directions, and that defines for you your temperature on your system. The other thing that's worth remarking upon in these kind of calculations is that although larger n is much more expensive than SU3, basically you're multiplying n by n matrices together, which is something that goes up as n cubed, things are often a bit better than that, because one of the things you find is that finite volume effect, first of all, the transition becomes stronger and becomes better defined on small volumes. In fact, it will become entirely well-defined on very small volumes as n goes to infinity. So whereas in SU3, you might be having to use 32 cubed, say, 5, if LT equals 5, 32 cubed 5 or 48 cubed 5 lattices, you can get an equivalently sharp transition in SU8 on 8 cubed 5 lattices. And if we went to higher n, you could do better than that. So actually, it doesn't get that much harder to look at larger n for thermodynamics like this. Okay, the other thing that you can calculate at the same time while you're calculating the deconfining transition, since its first order is calculate, well, first order for n greater than 3, greater than or equal to 3, is to look at the deconfinement, confinement latent heat. Here is a plot. Here is the large n limit. Nothing special about it. So when I put it in these units, so it's a mass over a mass, or energy over an energy. Here, take the fourth root to make it an energy over an energy. It just looks of order 1. Normalize it by n squared, of course, the number of degrees of freedom. So there's nothing special there. It's as you might expect it. The only thing to say that's special is SU3, which is weakly first order. As you can see there, the latent heat's a bit lower. In fact, SU3 is sort of notoriously, in some sense, weakly first order. At one point, people were arguing it might even be second order. And a lot of that is due, I think, to the fact that when you look at the interface tension between the confining and deconfined phases, and this determines, it's primarily the interface tension that determines how big of a spatial volume you need in order to see clean. What you want when you're determining the deconfining transition is to have large enough volumes so that you see the system is a long time in the confined phase and tunnels to the deconfined phase where it stays a long time and then tunnels backwards. And you, of course, extrapolate that to infinite volume. But you need to see some clear, it to be clearly in separate phases in order to be able to estimate estimate a value of the critical value on a finite volume. And if you have a very small surface tension, then that doesn't work very well. And that's in the case in SU3, as you see from this figure. So here is the surface tension between the confined and deconfined phases. And as you can see, that has a coefficient which is very small. Then n squared is multiplied by a small coefficient. Even if I took the third root to make it sort of an energy over an energy, that would still be about 0.25. So that's a small coefficient. And in addition, there's the negative piece here. So the SU3 tension between the two phases is very small. And it's only if you go to very large volumes that you see a clean separation between phases. Well, that's a pure gauge theory. What would happen in QCD at n equals infinity? Well, this is sort of trivial. Well, that we took together. I mean, okay, I should mention the SU3, I didn't mention this already, the SU3 deconfining temperatures, SU2 deconfining temperatures were taken from earlier works where they were calculated up to nt equals 12, I don't know, something like that, or even more. What we did is we did a more careful calculation. We did a careful calculation of the string tension, which changed actually TC over root sigma and the continuum extrapolation significantly. And we also did, for one NT, I think it was 5 or 6, we did a careful calculation just to make sure we were doing the same calculation as these other people before using their results as well. But for SU2 and SU3, this is basically from older calculations, which go back to the mid-90s or so. So I can't offhand tell you. Now, these other calculations for the interface tension was for LT equals 5. Oh, it is LT equals 5. I think everything here is for LT equals 5. Everything, yeah. Yeah, LT equals 5. In which case, it was probably our own calculation rather than other people's. The SU3 one, I mean. Okay, for for n equals infinity QCD, of course, at leading order, there are no fermions disappear. And so all you have is a simple phase diagram where you have a something which is independent of quark mass, a phase transition, going all the way down to zero quark mass. And the zero quark mass, of course, is always a subtle limit. It's a question how you take the zero mass limit and the n to infinity limit. You have to be careful here, so I leave that aside. And then I put a dashed line here because some of our string colleagues have seen another transition, which I hope will be talked about later in this meeting, but that's not something that I want to talk about. But the straight deconfining transition is just independent, of course, of the quark mass at n equals infinity. That's a trivial remark. There have been, but while I'm talking about QCD and fermions, there have been some nice calculations by Narayan and Neuberger looking at chiral symmetry and chiral symmetry breaking at large N. And this I've taken from a relatively recent paper, about a year old. And this is in the high temperature phase, looking at the gap in the Dirac eigenvalue spectrum, which shows that you have chiral symmetry breaking. Which shows you have chiral symmetry restoration at high temperatures. And they were just looking at how that goes to zero here as you approach the deconfined temperature from above. That's not the eigenvalue density. That's a gap. It's the gap in the eigenvalue spectrum at lambda equals zero. So there should be no gap if you want chiral symmetry breaking. As a function of little t, which is a sort of a rescaled temperature, I guess it's t minus tc over tc, something like that. Sorry, yes, I should have shown that. I should have said what that was. That is basically the temperature with one being tc. So this is I should have taken a plot which showed what happened at low, below tc, but it wasn't in the paper, so. But let me move on from that and just make a couple of comments about 2 plus 1 dimensions, where things are not really that different. They're different in detail, but otherwise not greatly different. And that may be interesting because, of course, this is, again, a theory that's accessible from our string colleagues. Yeah. Just a moment. All this is telling you. This is just telling you that you have chiral symmetry restored because of the gap. There's chiral symmetry restored above TC, and then they were discussing how there's a first order transition. So there's a jump here, and they were they were interested in what happens as you go through that transition. But basically, I don't think there's any other information here. I'm not sure. This is... The gap disappears in a sudden jump. The solid line is an interpolation, which suggests that if you go through this and stay in the metastable deconfined phase, you might have the gap going to zero smoothly. But that's another issue. I don't really want to go into that. That's something which is. But there is nothing here except, as far as I can see, there is nothing here. And you can see this is quite rough. This is all scattered. There are no errors on these points. This is quite scattered. But the scatter tells you something about the errors. This is just telling you that you have a chiral symmetry at these very large ends. You have chiral symmetry restored at in the deconfined phase, in the conventional deconfined phase, up to about 2.5 times the deconfining temperature. Nothing more. Well, yes, if you like. I mean, yeah. Okay, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, there is a very similar plot of TC over root sigma. These are continuum extrapolations for SU2, SU3, SU4, up to SU8. And in this case, both SU2 and SU3 happen to be second order. That was expected. And SU4 was always controversial because the related spin models could be second or first order. It turns out to be first order, at least in our calculation. And what you get is a deconfining temperature which is closer to 1. So it's larger than the one in 3 plus 1 dimensions. But in some sense, that's not surprising, certainly if you think of a string fluctuating in at high temperatures. There are more fluctuations in the higher the number of transverse dimensions in which it can fluctuate. And roughly speaking, that explains, for instance, if you take a Nambu-Goto string, that would explain the fact that TC is up by from about 0.6 to about 0.9. And that's also true if you think, I think, of a gluon plasma and the free energy of that. So this is no surprise that the deconfining temperature in units of the string tension is somewhat higher. So it looks very much like 3 plus 1 dimensions. The latent heat is also very much like, a bit smaller as well, but very much like 3 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so we have this deconfining transition. And one of the questions one might ask oneself when one goes from SU3 to larger N is whether there's a single deconfining transition. And the reason for asking this question is that when you think about the transition in terms of a usual order parameter, that involves a Polyakov loop, what you have across the transition is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, Zn. So the Zn symmetry gets spontaneously broken when you go to the deconfined phase. So in the continuum theory, this is like, the Zn symmetry is instead of having periodic boundary conditions, you have ones which are periodic up to a gauge transformation that's an element of the center. And of course, the gauge fields don't feel that, but a Polyakov loop does. It picks up a phase factor. On the lattice, you just multiply set of links by an element of the center, and that's a symmetry. So there is this symmetry which gets spontaneously broken at the deconfining transition. That's the normal way we think about it. However, you might imagine that, that this symmetry breaking occurs in several steps. For example, in SU4, Z4 to Z2 to 1. And physically, if that's the right word, that would correspond to, for example, saying that k equals 2 strings deconfine and k equals 1 strings are still confined. That's to say they're not broken. K equals 2 strings break before k equals 1 strings. And k equals 1 strings break at the final temperature. Now, that's, if one tries to think of that in physical terms in this kind of theory, it's hard to see that as very sensible. But nonetheless, it's worth looking at. And that's one of the things we did. And certainly, what we found is that to a very high accuracy, there's no sign of any multiple transitions. They look like one single transition, which is fine, because I think the physics would be a bit peculiar if there was more than one transition. So, let me now just make one final comment about this, and that is that, so this is not a piece of data, just comment about the fact that you have a finite temperature at large N. Basically, what you're doing is you're saying, at the transition, of course, the confining free energy, the free energy of confining states, and the free energy of these sort of states which consist of some finite density of gluons throughout the system, those have the same free energy. And at large N, the gluonic free energy should be of order N squared, while that of the confining system, well, you can look at the various pieces. If you look at the hadrons and the hadron masses, they're of order, of course, N to the zero. So the only piece in the confining system that is of order N squared is the vacuum energy density that brings it down. And so at TC, all this other stuff due to hadron masses should be irrelevant. And what you're doing is you're saying that the free energy of the gluon gas is essentially given by the vacuum energy density. There should be a factor of T here, I think, TC. But anyway, so these two should be, that's what at N equals infinity is being matched, the two things that are of order N squared. So if the vacuum energy density had been a bit deeper, then the TC would have been a bit higher, and maybe we would have been able to use weak coupling to calculate this, and we would have then had a calculation of the gluon condensate through weak coupling indirectly. But actually, of course, that's not the way things are. It seems that the gluon gas is strongly coupled, and we don't really know how to calculate this analytically, but except for maybe people working from ADS-CFT. So there you have maybe a way of calculating a gluon condensate through looking at the free energy of the strongly coupled gluon gas close to the phase transition. So that's just a comment aside. Well, I've mentioned the strongly coupled gluon plasma just now, and that, of course, is a focus of this meeting. And I don't really need to. Let me just say that. So the question really is, you've seen a lot of evidence from RIC, and you've seen some evidence also from lattice calculations that in SU3, you have a strongly coupled gluon plasma. Then there are the calculations on the string side, which are usually at n equals infinity. Is actually, if you look at the theory, SUN gauge theory at large n, does this strongly coupled gluon plasma persist? So one way for to look at that is to look at the pressure and compare it in SU3 and at larger n. And as well as the pressure, there is this quantity delta, which is the energy density minus 3 times the pressure, which is zero in the Stefan-Boltzmann gas. So here is a calculation by Brinkholz from about a year ago,
which compares, which shows you in the SUN gauge theory for n equals 3, 4, and 8, together with some older results, which is the solid green line, you can see how a suitably normalized version of this varies with temperature. The normalization doesn't really matter. The main issue is that you've got, that what you see here is that SU3, SU4, and SU8 are essentially the same, two very small corrections, throughout this region of temperatures where we were able to do calculations going from, well, we could do it higher, but we didn't, going from 1 to 2 times TC. So here you see that the one aspect of this, if you like, the strongly coupled gluon plasma in the pure SU engaged theory is something that is very much there at large n. It doesn't change when you go from SU3 to SU8 at all. And you see the same thing with the pressure here. And that, of course, you can say that means that whatever dynamics you have should be well, if you want to be economic with your dynamics, you should use the same dynamics, presumably at n equals 3 and n equals infinity, although that's not, of course, necessarily the case. But if you did decide to take that attitude, then you would say that, for example, color singlet hadrons above TC would not be giving you that kind of thing. Here, the color singlet hadrons are blue balls, of course. So that, I think, is quite a positive statement in terms of telling us that we can do calculations at large n, and they should be relevant, at least for these kind of quantities in SU3, although one should always check it for whatever quantity one's looking at. Well, what about the temperature dependence of the string tension? That's another thing that you can look at. And if you look at the temperature dependent of effective string tension from Podyakov loop calculations, you see something like this.
As you approach the deconfining transition, it drops and then jumps to zero above that.
However, there is a metastable region here. And one might wonder, since actually when you look at it, Nambu-Goto works pretty well here, you might wonder whether you can see something of a Hagedorn phase transition by following, by staying in the confined phase in the metastable region, which is quite large at large n.
And that was one thing that we try to do with Barak-Brinkholz. So the Hagedorn phase transition is a typical string condensation transition, or you can express it in terms of the mass spectrum of hadron states composed of closed strings like blue balls. You'll get the same result. It would happen at the same place, same temperature. And it comes from the fact that you have the exponentially growing number of ways of joining two points a distance L apart, it goes E to the L, so that overwhelms the Boltzmann factor at some point, and you get a kind of deconfinement there. So that's a deconfinement from the confining side. It doesn't say anything about a gluon plasma. And it would be kind of interesting to see if one could actually see some evidence for that. Of course, such a transition, the argument for such a transition, ignores the interactions among strings. So that's best at n equals infinity, where interactions between color singlets are zero. So if this kind of Hagedorn transition is going to show up in a clean way anywhere, it would be at large n. And so we try to follow, to go through the deconfining transition, stay in the confined phase, use the big metastability there to see whether we could get close to something like a second-order Hagedorn transition. Well, it wasn't entirely successful, but it was partly successful and, I don't know, partly not.
Here is what happens. Here's SU12, for example. Here's deconfining transition. We did get, here is the effective string tension, normalized by the zero temperature string tension. So it drops to about 0.55 by the time you're in the deconfined transition, but then we were able to follow it quite a bit further down to here, and you could try doing some extrapolations down here. So there's some sign that maybe you can get somewhere, but we didn't go far enough to be entirely confident that we could say there was a really Hagedorn transition.
Let me say, finally, with a couple of brief comments on a couple of other topics, I've talked about the usual string tension. There is a dual Hooft string tension, which is related to the flux between center monopoles. And that is zero in the confining phase and becomes non-zero in the deconfined phase. And there have been some calculations of this Hooft string tension, both by myself and a student, Francis Bursa, who's not a student anymore, he's a postdoc, and also by Philippe de Falcon with his group. So, and basically, here you see a calculation of this
string tension, and it drops almost to zero as you approach the deconfining transition from above.
And there's even a nice plot also from Philippe de Falcon, which is more accurate. We calculated the derivative of that with respect to temperature and had to reconstruct it. But Philippe had a nice method of
essentially calculating it directly. So
here it is. And so what? So this kind of plot, this is quite, I mean, these the Hooft string tension has to do with objects which disorder Wilson loops, if they're Pearson. So one idea of a Tufts was that these objects condensed in the are condensed in the confining phase, and every time they pierce intertwine a Wilson loop, they give you an appropriate factor of the center element, and a gas of these objects will automatically give you linear confinement. It's a simple calculation if they are doing that kind of work. If you go above the deconfining temperature, they're certainly there. And another way of looking at them is as interface walls between different deconfined phases where the Podyakov loop differs by an element of the center. That's what they are. But they're essentially these vortex lines in 2 plus 1 dimensions. There will be vortex tubes in 3 plus 1 dimensions. They're sheets, world sheets of these vortices, which essentially are, as I said, you consider your sources as being center monopoles rather than being the usual quarks or gluons. So that's quite interesting because what you see here, I mean,
if I had a plot of the string tension itself was coming down here and going to zero somewhere around here, and the Hooft tension does something very similar. So, so
there might be some hint of some kind of temperature approximate duality, certainly not exact, between the confining and the Hooft string tensions. So that's just a hint of something interesting there. Well, all I would say is that I want to stop more or less now, so I will just say that some of the other quantities that have been calculated, and I won't show you here, but in case you need them, you should know they're there. There are spatial string tensions at high temperature and at larger n that have been calculated, as well as those for K-strings. And also the Debye electric screening mass has been calculated for a range of temperatures above TC, both for SU3 and SU8. So these quantities are available if they're needed. So let me, at that point, since I've run out of time, finish with just a summary of some of the things I've mentioned. So the important point, I think, there was that the initial point in the preamble was that n equals infinity seems to be close to n equals 3, both for d equals 3 plus 1 and d equals 2 plus 1, for many quantities. And
particularly relevant was the fact that the sort of strong coupling gluon plasma signatures in the pressure and the epsilon minus 3p are unchanged when you go to large n. And then there have been a number of quantities that have been calculated and which I showed you and which exist in the literature.
And there's a number of other quantities, some of which I showed you and some of which I didn't have time to discuss, but I think I'd better stop there. Well, as you know, that will be harder unless you want me to do it in the quenched approximation. You don't want me to do it in the quenched approximation. Yeah. No, I agree. It can be. I mean, in fact, we have a project to do that, but whether it'll be done in a year, I don't know. But yes, those are interesting questions. Yes. Well, if you're called, well, there is the Iguchi Kawai model. I've been working for a couple of years on that with a student. And it turned out to be a much more complicated story than we initially expected. There were old calculations of the deconfining temperatures, you know, from the mid-80s by people, including John Kogut and other people, which did very rough calculations claiming to see a deconfining temperature using the twisted Iguchi Kawai model. Unfortunately, it turns out that, there is a whole range of couplings where, despite the twist, you break a center symmetry, which is not the one I've been talking about here, but related, and the center symmetry is crucial for having the correspondence between the reduced model and a large system in the planar limit. It's what you need in order to have the same equations for the Wilson loops. Otherwise, you have expectation values for open lines in the large system. So actually, that correspondence breaks down, and it's not clear whether we will ever be able to get a physical phase with the twisted Iguchi Kawai model, unfortunately. So there is a real problem there, which contradicts folklore going back 20 years, but unfortunately it's down there. You mean at n equals infinity, your statement? Yeah. I would have shown some explicit ones if I had time, which showed made precisely that point, but I didn't have time. No, I'm aware of that.